It's 5:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, President Obama announced last night that he's authorizing airstrikes on militant targets inside Iraq. Can the U.S. really help Iraq in its battle with Islamic radicals?
First, Wisconsin is no stranger to political protest, as that moment from the 2011 Capitol protest indicates. But a new survey from NBC News and the Wall Street Journal asked Americans whether they were upset enough about any issue to get out there and protest. And 57% of those sampled said yes, they were mad as heck, and they were ready to do something about it.
But that 57% number would actually be pretty good voter turnout in most years. Far fewer Americans will probably go out and participate in any form of protest.
So here's the question. What motivates us to protest, or what keeps us from doing it? David Meyer is an expert on political protest. He is a professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine. He blogs at Politics Outdoors, and his books include The Politics of Protest, Social Movements in America. David, welcome to the program.
It's great to be with you.
I want to start out with the specific question in the poll. It was, is there something that upsets you enough that if you could, you would carry a protest sign for a day? 57% of the Americans said yes to that very low level of protest. But do we have a sense of how many Americans actually engage in any form of public protest?
When they take polls about have you ever participated in protest, we get numbers between a quarter and 35-40% have ever participated in a protest. And as won't surprise you out in Madison, it's not an average. There are plenty of people who turn out all the time and plenty of people for whom it's just an occasional thing. So 57% is huge. Everybody's willing to protest. Everybody wants to go on a diet. Everybody wants to exercise. But you need the opportunity and just a little bit of extra motivation to actually get out there and do it.
And I'm wondering, and maybe you can help me out with this, how does that number compare with other periods in American history? You know, people think of the 60s, of course, but, you know, there were protests in the labor movements in the 30s. There are all kinds of other eras where people were out in the streets, or so it seemed. Do we have any indication of what those numbers may have looked like?
Yeah, it's a much smaller percentage of the American population in the past than it is now.
Really?
Protest has spread to far more causes further across the political spectrum than ever before. Now, that doesn't mean that there weren't more dramatic instances of protest at, you know, imagine, you know, at times in our history. There certainly are, you know, in the 1930s and the 1960s, mass civil disobedience, huge demonstrations. But I think we tend to forget the variety of the varieties of activism that are going on right now. There are, you know, I mean, just in the last few days, we've read about anti-immigration protesters showing up at these centers housing immigrant children, and immigrant rights protesters showing up at the same places to counter-demonstrate. Just in the last couple of weeks, we've had that court decision about an ongoing protest outside a woman's health clinic in Boston, Massachusetts. So when we look back at the labor protests of the 30s or the civil rights or anti-war protests of the 60s, we tend to forget about all the different things that are going on right now.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting because it kind of tells me that while more people, there's all these causes, at the same time, if people are devoting energy to a certain cause, it means they can't devote energy to another cause. And so, well, there may be more protests, it's more diffuse in a way.
Absolutely. There are more, you know, I did a little study of protests at political conventions. You know, when they have the conventions in 2016, you know, activists are going to show up outside the Republican convention and protest every issue under the sun, and same thing at the Democratic convention. Well, this goes back ever since there are conventions. But in the old days, there would tend to be one or two overarching issues. And nowadays, it's a laundry list represented by a whole range of different groups. and the kind of interesting movements of the last several years have embraced a laundry list within. And I'm thinking about the Tea Party on the right and Occupy on the left. And you say, well, what was the Tea Party about? You know, there are lots of answers to that. The Tea Party was about limited government. The Tea Party was about social conservatism. The Tea Party was about repealing the 17th Amendment to the Constitution. And you ask, what was Occupy about? And we can say this overarching thing about political and economic inequality, but if you read through any of the Occupy manifestos, there must be a different word for pluralizing manifesto.
But, manifesti or something.
Manifesti, yes. If you read through all of them, there's a boatload of issues. There are a lot of things that people are concerned about. And one thing doesn't come out and unify them unless there's a lot of organizing work to do it or unless there's some sort of crisis unifying people. So, I mean, oh, by the way, remember Keystone? There's still protests on both sides of that issue going on.
Mm-hmm.
And then I suspect the other little piece of this story, which has got to be very familiar to you in Wisconsin, is we have frequent elections in America. And if people think that they can get what they want through elections, they're likely to engage in electoral activity in addition to or instead of demonstrating out in the streets. And my read, and you can tell me if this is true in Wisconsin, is that there's a lot of focus on the election as a vehicle for getting what you want.
I would say there's a lot of focus on the election right now, and we will see how it all turns out. Earlier you said, you know, when people want to protest, when they're thinking about this, they need the opportunity and they need the motivation. Talk a little bit more about that, and then maybe try to take that from the individual into a larger group. How does it become something that becomes larger than just one lone person out there?
Well, there are saints and psychopaths who are going to turn out to protest no matter what, and they're going to self-recruit, and they're going to make their own signs, and they're going to be there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we admire the saints, and we are a little nervous around the psychopaths, but we've seen them if we've ever been to demonstrations. We've seen them both. Most people, however, have to think that protest has a possibility of helping them get what they want, and it's the best possibility they have for getting what they want. In other words, for most people, if you can get what you want by sending a check to, I mean, name your cause, you're likely to do that. Or pulling a lever in the voting booth, you're likely to do that. You protest when you think it's necessary and potentially effective. And most people are not self-recruiters. Most people get recruited. Actually, the best predictor of who shows up is who gets asked personally. And, you know, that takes dedicated organizing. That takes people going around, going to meetings, in the modern era, sending out emails, posting stuff on websites, organizing events. Sometimes it means knocking on doors. Sometimes it means getting a parade permit and reserving a sound system and printing flyers. And that's a large investment of effort. It usually takes money, though not always. It always takes substantial labor, and that doesn't happen by itself. You know, I mean, when you read the poll, and that was a great way to start the show, thank you. When you read the poll, there's this premise that if people are unhappy, then protest automatically materializes. But it actually takes a lot of organizing to make things happen. And right now, let's look at the big organizations that have mounted protest movements in the past. Well, organized labor is desperately trying to defend itself. And, you know, Wisconsin's not the only story there, but it's certainly the signal one. The Tea Party groups and the people who funded the Tea Party groups are heavily, heavily, heavily invested in the election instead. Okay, so those are groups on the left and right that are working other routes to try to get what they want right now or to protect what they already have. And then, you know, I'm just thinking about like the whole range of issues we've seen in the last couple of years and how it's hard to build a broad coalition around any of them. You know, I mean, gun politics are still a big issue in much of the United States, but it's not something that trumps every other issue for most people.
All right, we're going to take a couple of moments here and take a break. And when we return, we'll continue talking to sociologist David Meyer about political protest in the United States, what motivates people to protest, or what keeps them from doing it.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We continue our conversation about political protest and why Americans get involved or not. Our guest is David Meyer, professor of sociology at the University of California, Irvine. His books include The Politics of Protest.
And you can call now at 800-642-1234 with your questions or to share your experiences. Have you gone out and protested something? Maybe in the last few years, maybe back in the 60s, 800-642-1234, or have you helped organize a protest? Do you want to tell us how unspontaneous those things are? How much work goes in behind the scenes? Love to hear your story. 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
David, before the break, you were talking about how people, when they get together to protest, see it as a sort of a means to an end. And you could look at that and say, well, they're being very opportunistic, that this is a good way to go, or they're desperate, that there is no other way to go. Do you know which one of those two paths are chosen most often?
I don't think they're mutually exclusive. I think people who protest usually do other things as well. And I think just because it's a means to an end doesn't mean it's not something that you get something else out of. So if I go to a restaurant, I need to nourish myself, but I hope to enjoy the food. If I want to protest about nuclear power in 1979 and there's this added bonus that Bruce Springsteen is going to play, well, those two things are synergistic and work together. And a smart organizer will play on both of those things simultaneously. You know, I mean, one of the crazy things about your protests in Madison just, I guess, 2 years ago, mm-hmm. is even though it was really cold and really desperate, it looked like people were having some fun at the same time. And it looked like they were feeling some satisfaction in connecting with others who shared their values.
And I would add to that by saying that there was a lot of organization I know that took place, and there were, you know, entertainers of one kind or another who were out there, and it went on over a fantastic period of time. And you think about the work that went into that, it was really impressive in that regard. One other question I want to ask before we get to calls, you know, people all over the world these days are protesting about something. Is there something unique about the way Americans protest, or is a protest a protest a protest no matter where you go?
You know, I wish I had something systematic about this, but I don't. What I've discovered in, you know, just selected attendance of meetings, you know, in different countries, is that American activists tend to be relentlessly pragmatic. They tend to talk about, like, how do we do what we need to do to make this thing happen? And, you know, that's what Tocqueville said defines Americans. I also think that, and I don't want to sugarcoat this or make this sound too soft, but Americans are relatively tolerant of protest as a political activity. Now, that this doesn't mean, I mean, I know enough about American history, we all do, to know that the American government has stomped down harshly on occasion on protesters who were carrying unpopular causes. That said, if you walk down in front of the White House or, you know, Capitol Hill, you'll see somebody holding a sign who won't be cleared out. You know, we're more tolerant than we give ourselves credit for, and less tolerant than we ought to be.
Let's go to the phones now and see what listeners have to say. We begin in Brookfield, and Dawn joins us. Hi, Dawn.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I was involved in the Iraq War protest that happened in Milwaukee around a lot of coffins being draped with flags, and felt very strongly to be there. It was the first time that I've ever protested. And if I feel strongly in something like that, I will definitely do it again.
So let me ask you this, Dawn. I mean, what was the trigger for you? What was the moment when you said, you know, I've seen enough, I have to go do something?
I think it was the, to be quite honest, the lack of publicity around how many people were dying at the time, how many soldiers. They would put some ads in the Milwaukee Journal, not ads, but, you know, publications of, you know, a little article on who passed away from Wisconsin. And I thought, well, if Wisconsin has this many, then the nation as a whole is mourning. And it was made very light of, you know, there was no go out and do something for your country, you know, like they used to have war bonds and things like that. And I think the lack of publicity around how many people were actually being killed just really bothered me, and especially the fact that the Iraqi war was unnecessary.
All right, Dawn, thanks for those comments. And David Meyer, do you hear that story a lot, that there's an individual in one moment, all of a sudden there's something that just has sort of built up over time, and now they have to move from reading into action?
That's the way people tell the story, but there's always accumulation. You know, I mean, when we tell stories about ourselves, we make it dramatic. We set up critical moments. You know, the moment our eyes met, then I knew. But there's always a long history that leads up to those dramatic moments. And the war protests that Dawn talked about, that's a really great and very, very disturbing example of how protest relates to policy. I mean, Dawn talked about war bonds. You know, in previous eras, when we had a draft, many, many, many American families would be touched by a war. And in the last wars that we fought in Afghanistan and Iraq, a very small portion, tiny sliver of the American population has borne huge costs for conducting those wars. And it's allowed other Americans to turn away from it and pay attention to the other issues of the moment or their lives. So the absence of a draft is something that stopped that protest movement from continuing forever. The other thing that was strange is when your guy is president, it's a little harder to get people out in the streets. When President Obama took office running against the wars, the number of self-identified Democrats at those demonstrations, anti-war demonstrations, began to decline. And you saw much more vociferous opposition to deficit spending when Obama was in office than we did when George W. Bush was in office, who is also a great deficit spender. When your guy is in office, you tend to give him a little bit of a break. And that kind of limits the growth of movements sometimes.
As you look ahead to the future, and I'm thinking kind of partly of the social media aspect, and you talked about, you know, sort of the sheer number of things that are being protested now, what, in your estimation, does the future of protest look like? Is it going to be continuing to divide more and more and more, or do you think there will be a coming together over larger causes, or is it really impossible to tell?
I have my favorite picks about what comes up next, but I'm usually wrong about that. So I think that there is still an overriding concern with economic inequality, which has been taken up by mainstream politicians, as Standard & Poor's released a report about how economic inequality hurts the GDP. So that seems like that's something possible. I always wonder about educational access, which always seems like a salient issue to me. But, you know, I live in a university, so maybe I've got a distorted view of that. I always see those things as potentially overarching links. But, you know, the world just offers continual surprises. Nobody predicted the Tea Party. Nobody predicted Occupy, or the people who predicted it 20 times before it happened. So I wish I knew.
Well, that's a pretty good way to leave it. And when the next big one comes up, we'll have you on and talk about it. David, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
That was David Meyer, professor of sociology and political science at the University of California, Irvine. He blogs at Politics Outdoors.
I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, it's Food Friday. We'll head out to the grill for some tasty marinades, along with fun drinks to sip while we're tending that barbecue.
But first, President Obama announced last night that he had authorized limited airstrikes on Islamic militants in Iraq.
The president said that American plans are also dropping aid and supplies to religious minorities who are fleeing the Muslim extremist group, the Islamic State, also known as ISIS.
So is the U.S. getting dragged into another war in the Mideast? And just how effective can the U.S. be in this conflict? With us now is Stephen David, professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome to Central Time, Stephen.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Yeah, I want to back up a few days and talk about the choices that were facing the president. Did he have any good ones?
No. Look, Obama was elected in large part getting us out of Iraq and Afghanistan. And to a large extent, he's done that. And so it must have been very difficult for him to be dragged back in.
And so as we heard his announcement last night, you know, I think one of the stories I read, he was very somber, which I would expect. He did not, and somebody else, there was some analysis that said nobody could accuse him of being enthusiastic about this. Is that the way you see it?
Sure. I mean, he did not want to put Americans in harm's way back in Iraq. I think it's the last thing he wanted to do. And while he is reaffirmed that we're not going to have boots on the ground, I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, well, one thing can lead to another, and let's say the airstrikes are not effective in stopping ISIS. What's next? And are we going to get back into this mess despite our best intentions?
And so, as I understand it, there are two issues here, or two courses of action, the humanitarian aid and then the airstrikes. We've already seen a couple rounds of airstrikes and some humanitarian aid being delivered. Are these are, you know, so sort of part of the same larger strategy. Talk a little bit about not the airstrikes just yet, but the humanitarian aid aspect of it, because this is an important element. The U.S. has had this opportunity to provide humanitarian aid in other countries before. Why Iraq? Why now?
Well, a lot of things have come together. First, the Yazidi and Christian communities that are being targeted by an especially brutal, horrific group, ISIS or the Islamic State. I mean, these guys are running through northern Iraq and Syria. They're coming into towns, and anyone who doesn't adopt their version of Islam has a choice. They either have a forced conversion, well, they're killed, and sometimes they agree to convert, and they're killed anyway. And, you know, the word genocide is often thrown around loosely where it doesn't belong. But much of what's going on here is genocidal. I mean, especially with the Yazidi community, ISIS really wants to wipe these people out. And it wants to create this caliphate, this Islamic State across Iraq and Syria, and further, if it can so achieve, throughout the Middle East, where minorities and even Muslims who don't adhere to their branch of Islam have no place. And so you have these people who are running away. They're on this mountaintop. They're dying of hunger and thirst. Children are dying. To turn a blind eye to that when America might be able to stop it, that's asking an awful lot.
And then at the same time, we've got the airstrikes. And how do you go about, if you are the president, if you are the Iraqis, measuring the success of those? Do those areas actually, do we turn back the ISIS forces? Do we just stop them? Do we what?
My sense is, at least initially, the purpose of the airstrikes is simply to provide cover for the cargo planes that are dropping the humanitarian assistance. The cargo planes fly very low. They don't go very quickly. And they're very vulnerable to ground fire from the ISIS forces. So by having suppressing fire from the F-18s, the planes themselves are protected. A more ambitious goal would be to push ISIS back. And I don't think that can be done through the air. Certainly, I think the airstrikes can help, but you need a determined and skilled ground component. And so far, we don't have that. I mean, the Iraqi army turned out to be a joke. I mean, despite the billions of dollars and efforts and blood we poured into that institution, it just broke and ran. The hope and expectation was that the Kurds would do better. The Peshmerga forces were seen to be much tougher and more resolute. But they've been overwhelmed also, probably because they've been outgunned. A lot of the ISIS forces have taken equipment that America supplied to the Iraqi army and has turned it against the Kurds, who are simply outgunned in terms of what they're up against. So I think has to happen now, and what I guess will happen, is that America will supply far more military aid to the Kurds. We didn't do this before because we felt we were interfering in the sovereign authority of Iraq. You know, Kurdistan is nominally part of the greater Iraqi state. If we give them weapons, they might be using them against the Iraqis or using them to create an independent Kurdish state, which can cause instability elsewhere. So we held back, but now I think we're not going to hold back much more. They're the one force, perhaps with the remnants of the Iraqi army, that can stop these guys.
And the president last night did seem to draw a line when he said there's no American military solution to this, meaning, I presume, boots on the ground. Is that a line he's going to be able to hold to? I mean, politically, it sure is one I imagine he wants to.
I think despite the horrendous nature of this situation, I think it would be very, very difficult for Obama to put large numbers of American troops back in Iraq. Now, bear in mind, we've already reinserted several hundred advisors back in Iraq, and my guess is that was difficult for him to do also. But the notion of a large-scale intervention along the lines of the Iraqi war, I don't think we're prepared to do that, no.
And you alluded earlier to the idea of a slippery slope. How big of a possibility is that? What should people be looking for if they want to avoid that?
Well, I guess the red line for Obama would probably be a large-scale intervention of American forces. I don't think he or the American people are prepared to do that. That said, there are a lot of other things we can do. We can work with regional allies. Again, we can arm the Kurds. We can provide military advisors. We can have more robust airstrikes. But at the end of the day, if it requires a large-scale intervention by American forces, I think that's not a bridge he's prepared to cross. And that must be difficult for him, too. I mean, on the one hand, he doesn't want to put American forces there. On the other hand, again, it's hard to turn a blind eye to these horrific massacres that are occurring. I mean, this group is supposedly even too brutal for al-Qaeda. And the strategic significance of ISIS taking over large portions of the Middle East are devastating. You know, look, a lot of attention has been focused on the Israeli war with Gaza, and I don't mean to minimize the horror and suffering of the people in Gaza. But strategically, this is a much bigger deal because you're talking about a group that can take over the heartland of the Middle East that's dedicated to the most extreme form of Islamic terrorism. That's something the United States or pretty much any other reasonable country does not want to see happen.
So given all of that, did the president really have the option of doing nothing, of just looking at all these things and saying, you know, now is not the time to get involved?
He did. I mean, you always have that option with a humanitarian affair. Look, by some estimates, 4 million people have died in the civil war in Congo, and the United States is not involved, nor are there efforts to bring us, to make us involved. In Somalia in 1994, in Rwanda in 1994, 800,000 people were massacred, and the United States did nothing, and the world continued to spin. Right now, with the world's attention on the Middle East, maybe this is too difficult to ignore. And, you know, I have to say I'm conflicted myself. I don't want to see another American intervention in the Middle East. But it's gut-wrenching to see what these people are doing. So did Obama have an option? Yes. I mean, he could have simply said, this is not our fight. We're going to evacuate the American personnel in Kurdistan, and they've got to work it out themselves. And I suspect a fair number of the American people maybe would go along with that. Perhaps the fact that Christian communities are being targeted and the Pope is involved has made this kind of avoidance more difficult. But in the end of the day, if he chose to turn a blind eye, he could have.
Well, that's a good place to leave it. Thanks so much for being with us today, Stephen.
My pleasure.
We've been talking with Stephen David, a professor of political science at Johns Hopkins University. This is Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. The Packers preseason starts tomorrow, meaning it's time to kick up our grilling to the next level. On today's edition of Food Friday, our guest brings a few interesting twists to the traditional barbecue marinades.
And since marinating takes time, why not mix up some interesting summer beverages to keep you company?
Here to help us with both is Food Friday guest Ian Knauer. He's a farm-to-table chef and host of the PBS series The Farm, and he has a cookbook out by that name. Ian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Always good to be here.
Well, let's start with marinades. Before we get into the particular suggestions you have, how important is marinade to a good barbecue?
Well, it all depends on what you're cooking. If you are cooking a really flavorful, fatty steak, then I wouldn't marinate it at all. You know, something like a ribeye or even a skirt steak, just need some salt and pepper before you throw it on the grill. So it depends on what you're cooking, you know, to sort of vaguely avoid your question there.
Well, but for drier stuff, like a chicken breast, not a lot of fat there. I feel like if I don't marinate that, I've got bad chicken in the offing.
Well, not necessarily bad, but yeah, you're right. Marinating is a really easy way to get a lot of flavor into a cut of meat that might have a little less fat in it, like a chicken breast, or it might be a little bit tougher, like maybe like a sirloin steak, for instance. So sirloin steaks can be really excellent on the grill, but they need a little time to sort of relax, and there are certain ingredients that help them do that. Acid is one, salt is another, and both acid and salt are very common ingredients in most marinades. So you're basically kind of pre-cooking your meat for a tougher cut when you're marinating it.
So let's talk about some specific marinades. This one caught my eye, Mojo marinade. What exactly is that all about?
Well, actually, I'm going to call it Mojo from now on. It's pronounced Mojo.
Oh, okay, well, good for me.
I was saying Mojo, too. Or really like Mojito, maybe. Mojo.
Exactly,
okay.
I like Mojo.
And similar, well, I like Mojo better, too, yeah. Similar to a Mojito, it often has lime juice in it. Now, this one that I think I sent you has lime juice and orange juice. And, again, that's where your acid is. So that acid is going to work on the meat to tenderize it as it's marinating before you put it on the grill. So this one has the orange juice, the lime juice. It's got some garlic in there, which, of course, adds a ton of flavor, and some fresh cilantro. So it's a really nice, fresh, kind of bright marinade for summer grilling.
It sounds like it would be great with, like, a pork.
Pork is perfect for that. In fact, most commonly it's used with pork. But it's also great with chicken. It's great with steak as well. I use it on just about everything.
Yeah, are a lot of marinades multilingual like that? You can translate them into different kinds of meat?
They are, yeah. And you know, multilingual is sort of an interesting word to use because a lot of marinades come from different places in the world where the population might not have access to more expensive cuts of meat.
Oh.
Therefore, they have to come up with ways to tenderize them, and so they'll use these marinades. Mojo is a really good example. That's a South American marinade where you could take a tougher cut of pork or steak and tenderize it with a marinade.
And now for a marinade basic, how long, you know, do we take? I've had some people, you know, we 24 hours. Other people want to press it a little more, less than that. What's a good kind of rule of thumb?
Well, I hate to disappoint you, but the answer is it all depends.
You're worse than a politician, Ian.
Exactly. Depends on how big your cut of meat is. So, you know, we're talking about pork. If you want to marinate a whole pork shoulder, like a pork butt, mm-hmm. which can be really amazing on the grill, you know, you cook it for hours until it falls off the bone, you would want to marinate that at least 24 hours because it's such a big, thick cut of meat. But if you're dealing with something that's thinner, you know, or like kebabs, you know, mm-hmm. small cubes of meat, you can really actually get away with an hour or two beforehand. So anywhere between those is the answer. And I know that that doesn't give you a rule of thumb at all, but that's the honest answer.
Hey, barbecuing is an art, not a science. Well, let's move on to another marinade. You gave us one with an Asian twist for tuna with a miso glaze. Tell us about that one.
Yeah, so miso is a really interesting ingredient, and you can get it at a lot of supermarkets now in the refrigerator section. It's a fermented soy paste, so it's kind of like soy sauce in a way. It comes from a soybean. It was made in a very different process. And because it's fermented, it's basically alive. So it's kind of like a culture, like yogurt, for instance. And because it is what it is, it acts to tenderize meat. There's also a fair amount of salt in it. So it acts as a really good tenderizer and also a flavor booster. There's a ton of umami in this stuff. So anything that you put it on is going to taste better. Not necessarily taste like miso, but your steak will taste steakier, for instance.
You had Gene at fermented soy paste.
Actually, you did have me at fermented. So there's another more traditional one here that I'm looking at that includes soy sauce and vinegar and maple syrup with that sweet component to it.
Yeah, this is a really super simple marinade. It's one that I go to all the time because I always have the ingredients right in my kitchen. You got soy sauce. It's equal parts soy sauce, maple syrup, and balsamic vinegar. So you have a salty element, a sweet element, and an acidic element, and they work together really harmoniously. I like to cook that with steak a lot because it has a lot of flavor to it. But again, it's one of those that goes with just about anything. So if you've got pork or if you've got chicken, it's really good with all of those choices.
And before we move on to beverages, the food safety people we have on from time to time will want us to say, once you've used the marinade on the raw meat, don't put it back on the cooked meat. Am I right?
Well, that's right. You can reuse it, but you want to put it in a saucepan and bring it up to a boil. And that way it'll be safe, and you'll kill anything that might be lurking in there. So you don't necessarily have to throw it away, but you do want to bring it up to a boil just to make sure that you're safe.
Okay. Yeah. Well, let's move on to beverages and don't just drink that marinade. Now, a lot of people here, of course, will just drink beer while they're grilling. Sure. You've got a couple fun non-alcoholic grilling recommendations, one with cantaloupe.
Yeah, so melon is one of my favorite things to drink in the summer. If you get a really nice cantaloupe, you could do this with honeydew or watermelon also. Cut it into cubes, stick it in the blender with just a little bit of sugar and maybe a cucumber or some mint, and whiz it up until it's a liquid. You don't even need to strain it, and it makes for just an unbelievably refreshing summer drink. A really fun thing to do is to cut that melon up into cubes and stick the cubes in the freezer until they're solid. And then blend that. You end up with a frozen version,
nice.
Like a frozen margarita without the booze. And, of course, you can always add the booze if you want. I am quite fond to put rum in my cantaloupe cocktails.
That sounds really good.
That does sound really good. Now, one of the prettier drinks that we've seen is the Green Lantern. It is gorgeous, I have to say. And listeners can see it if it's up on our Facebook page. Tell us what's in it. What makes it so pretty?
Well, the thing that makes the Green Lantern so pretty is actually the parsley. And before you decide to change the channel.
Yeah, exactly.
Parsley is a really great addition to a drink, you know, and green juices have become really popular all over the country. This is kind of in that vein. So you're blending up parsley. I think there's some lime juice in there, a little bit of sugar. I like to then strain that and top it off with some seltzer water. It's a really great breakfast drink, but also if you want to have that as a cocktail, gin is a really nice addition to that too.
All right. Well, what are your weekend grilling plans? I know you'll be watching the Packers game tomorrow night, Ian.
I sure will be out here in, on the East Coast. I'm gonna have a really fun weekend. Tomorrow I'm having a gardening workshop at my cooking school, and we're going to harvest everything, and then we're going to grill it for dinner. So I'm excited for that.
That is straight farm to grill to table. Ian, thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
That's Chef Ian Knauer, host of a new PBS series. It's called The Farm. He's got a cookbook by the same name. We've got a couple of the recipes we've talked about today over at the Central Time Facebook page, including the Green Lantern. And I think it's worth a look at the picture, too. It's a drink that's fun to look at as well, I imagine, to drink. I haven't tried it myself.
And as far as I'm concerned, it is the Mojo Mojo.
Mojo.
I renamed it that way.
Wow.
Yeah, you like that?
Yeah.
For the marinade?
Yeah, bring that in next time, Gene.
All right. I'm Gene Purcell, filling in today for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.